Sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahaye, tejasvinavadhitamastuma vidvishavahaye. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om. Good. Welcome back. After a break, we resume this class, and I think we're going to wrap it up tonight because we're coming to the end of the topic. You know, this class, we didn't have a text or anything to guide us, so it was based on the topic. And the rule is when you're done with a topic, stop. Nothing is worse than a teacher, a lecturer who just goes on and on and on and on. The big picture, if you remember, we started with that inward turned inquiry, and then we did the outward turned inquiry. And tonight we're going to pull those two aspects together. Before we do that, though, there's a couple of nice questions. We'll address these questions first, and then we'll do that closing portion. Oh, thank you. So, origin. How do Ishvara and Maya originate? Knowing that Brahman does not create anything, and any creation involves intention and process. So, Brahman indeed did not create Ishvara or Maya. Brahman is not a creator. By the way, Brahma, interesting. The dictionary word Brahman can be either neuter or masculine. So when Brahman is neuter, it's the Brahman we're talking about, the substratum of reality. But Brahman can also be declined in the masculine gender, in which it becomes Brahma. And we often say Brahmaji, and that's where we're talking clearly about God as creator. That's not our discussion right here. So knowing that Brahman does not create Ishvara and Maya, then where does Ishvara and Maya come from? Well, here's a problem. We have to expand our minds enough to understand the concept of eternality, or something that exists without being caused. In fact, this is... Actually, let's take the second question first, and then we'll come back to that one. You know, second question also is about eternality and that which is uncaused. The universe, second question, the universe re-emerges due to our karma. We had a nice discussion about that. When the universe is in a resolve condition, all of the karmas of the creatures who lived in the prior kalpa, the prior cycle of creation, those karmas have not yet all fructified. So for the sake of the fructification of the karmas of all the jivas in that resolve condition, the universe has to become manifest. So in that way, the law of karma drives the next cycle of creation. But then the question, of course, comes, how did the universe first originate when there were no people and no karma? And here we have to, there's two kinds of eternality. This is called a cyclic eternality. That is, this universe is a product of the prior universe, is a product of the prior universe. Suppose we, from the standpoint of modern science, we say this universe began with the Big Bang. Suppose that Big Bang was the leftovers of the prior Big Bang. We don't know that, but I'm just saying suppose. Suppose 14 billion years ago, that Big Bang was the product, the result of the prior Big Bang. Then you say, well, what was that Big Bang the result of? That was the result of the prior Big Bang, which was the result of the prior one, So here we're talking about a cyclic universe. Cyclic means like a circle. Where does a circle begin and end? A circle has no beginning and end. It just keeps going and going and going. So in the same way, we can talk about cyclic eternality for the universe. This universe is a product of the prior universe. Or if we take it from the standpoint of the jivas and karmas, then we ask the question, when was your first birth? Same issue, right? When was your first birth? This birth was a result of the prior one, which was a result of the prior one, which was a result of the prior one. So if we ask which was the first birth, you've made a wrong assumption. Who says there was a first birth? We look at it as an infinite series of births for every jiva, an infinite series of universes, which means there was no first birth for the jiva. There was no first creation of the universe. Do you remember long ago having a math class where you learned a number line? The teacher put a dot in the middle and said zero. Then draw an arrow in one direction and put plus infinity. Then drew an arrow in the other direction and said minus infinity. And as students, we had to come to understand that it's possible for numbers have no end. If you start adding up numbers, when do you get to the end? That's plus infinity or minus infinity. So we can learn to grapple with this idea of infinity, an infinite number of prior universe versus an infinite number of births for every jiva. So in that way, no first birth for the jiva, no first creation for the universe. Then, the related question, how did Maya and Ishvara originate? Now, we don't say that Ishvara is a result of the prior, Ishvara is a result of the prior, or Maya is a result of the prior Maya. So, 2 minutes of philosophy. There are two kinds of eternality. Very sophisticated. Two kinds of eternality. So far we're talking about a cyclic universal eternality. Cycle after cycle. If you like Sanskrit, the term for this is eternal nitya. Eternality nityatva. This cyclic eternality is called pravaha nityatva. Pravaha means flow. And the reference is to the flow of water in a river. It just keeps flowing and flowing and flowing. So in the same way, the cycle of universes keeps flowing and flowing and flowing. The cycle of jivas keeps flowing and flowing and flowing. So scholars call that pravaha nityatvam, the continual cycle of flow. That kind of nityatva, eternality, cannot apply to Ishvara and Maya. So this universe is a prior result of the prior universe. This Ishvara, you can't say Ishvara is a result of the prior. By the way, in Hindu mythology, you can say that this Indra is not eternal. The current in Hindu mythology, Indra is only the king of the gods for his lifetime. And then after he dies, at the end of this kalpa, then in the next kalpa, there'll be another Indra. And after that, another Indra, and after that, another Indra. Another example of pravaha nityatva. But Ishvara is not like Indra. Ishvara is it, the source of everything. And Ishvara is endowed with this power of maya, without which Ishvara cannot be the creator, sustainer, destroyer. So, and you correctly said that Ishvara and maya were not created by Brahman. Brahman is not the creator of Ishvara and Maya. So then we have to say, where does Ishvara and Maya, when did they come, how did they come, how were they created? And here we have the other kind of nityatva, the other kind of eternality, a kind of eternality which is not cyclic, that which is causeless. Little subtle, but you'll understand this. In the universe, there's such a thing as cause and effect. I just stay with the English. So when something is created, there's a cause, and whatever is created is the effect. The universe is created, so the universe is the effect for which there's a cause. What is the cause? The prior universe, we could say. So all of this goes on. This cyclic eternality happens within this bubble of cause and effect. This bubble of cause and effect is the universe. Cause and effect is a principle that belongs to the universe. Make sense? Cause and effect belong to the universe. Suppose we step outside of this bubble. If we want to talk about Ishvara and Maya, we're talking about that which is the cause for the universe, but not a cause in time and space. Which is to say that this Ishvara is the source of this cycle of creation, this eternal cycle of creation. Ishvara is the source for it, but the Ishvara which is the source for this cycle of creation, that Ishvara lies outside of its creation. Ishvara is the source of the cyclic universe. Let this bubble represent the cyclic universe. Cause and effect is part of the cyclic universe. Ishvara, with the power of Maya, is the source from which the cyclic universe came, but Ishvara lies outside. Ishvara is not part of the universe. We could say the universe is part of Ishvara, we can say, but we cannot say Ishvara is part of the universe. So therefore, this is a matter of logic. Ishvara logically lies outside of the universe. Outside of the universe, there's no cause-effect relationships. Cause-effect relationships only exist within the universe. Outside of the universe, there's no such thing as cause-effect relationships. So Ishvara does not... First of all, Ishvara lying outside of cause-effect relationships, Ishvara is uncaused. It's kind of a strange concept. Ishvara and Maya are uncaused. They're also eternal, but this uncaused eternality is very different from the pravaha nityatva, the cyclic eternality. So the universe has cyclic eternality. Ishvara and Maya have uncaused eternality. They're also eternal, but they're eternal in a different way. They never had a cause. There was no cause, because cause comes later. Cause is what comes from Ishvara. But then Ishvara and Maya themselves have no cause. This is a little philosophical, but that's the nature of these questions. We have to learn how to handle this topic of eternality, both the cyclic eternality of the universe, cyclic eternality of the jiva, and now the uncaused eternality of Ishvara and Maya. Okay. And the last question here is the universe and its people just Ishvara's dream? So we use that very powerful dream metaphor. And metaphorically, we could say that the world is like Ishvara's dream. Absolutely. Just as you create your dream world, which is inside you, non-separate from you, we could say metaphorically that Ishvara creates this world like a dream. It is projected by him, created, sustained, returns to him. It's within him. He pervades it. So all the aspects of the dream apply. But we shouldn't forget this is a metaphor. Dream is a metaphor, which means it helps us understand. Ishvara is not, we cannot say the world is Ishvara's dream because dreaming is something human beings do. Ishvara is not like your cha-cha-ji. Ishvara is not a human being, not like your uncle or grandfather or anything like that. So here, the dream metaphor is extremely useful, but let's not overextend the metaphor. You know, if you overextend the metaphor, then you have, remember the transcendent part of the dream metaphor? So you are laying in your bed in your home. So if Ishvara is dreaming this universe, where, you get the point? Where is he laying down? In what universe is he laying down while he's dreaming this universe? So it becomes silly, and it's absolutely not what the ancient rishis taught. So that dream is a metaphor, an analogy to help us understand. So we can say the world is like Ishvara's dream. Absolutely. It is very helpful. But to say that the world is Ishvara's dream is a mistake. Yeah, the rishis never intended that. Okay, good questions. Now, we can come to the conclusion of this subject matter. It could be helpful if I give the overview up on the board and then show you the nice connection. So, as I commented before, we began with this inner inquiry where we said, who am I? The knower, the observer, the conscious being. And the result of that inquiry, remember the drishya viveka, anything known to you is separate from you, that led us to identify who is the knower, who is that conscious witness. And ultimately, we ended up using the word atma to describe that conscious being. And let's just reflect on some of the language we use. The words conscious being are really important. Conscious being. There you go. Conscious being. Sat chit. And a conscious being, which is the source of happiness, contentment, fullness, and peace. We've just summarized the first dozen classes or so. That was the opening topic. The truth of who you are, anything known to you is not you, and the truth of that knower is a conscious being, which is the source of contentment, peace, and happiness. It's amazing how simple it is when you look at it in this way. It's incredibly simple. We tend to make things complicated, but in general, truth is simple. Ignorance is complicated. Truth is simple. So this was our inner inquiry. Then we did the outer inquiry. And if you remember how we began that inquiry, I think we began with the table. And we did the analysis. So, okay, what is this table? And we said it's wood. So table is form, wood is content. But then wood is form and fibers are content. And we went deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And we said, hey, there, all we find is an infinite series of forms. But then we reasoned that if a single form cannot exist without a content, table cannot exist without some kind of content, if a single form cannot exist without some underlying content, then an infinite series of forms could not exist without some kind of underlying reality, underlying content. We call that underlying reality or content Brahman. And just a name. Brahman is the name of that underlying reality because of which this infinite series of forms exists. That Brahman then is the reality because of which the universe exists. And then we said that Brahman, as the underlying source for the universe, we reasoned, we made use of the insights of the rishis, supported by reasoning, to know that this Brahman being absolute reality is not capable of the act of creation. It is just pure existence. Pure existence can't do anything. It's like clay is the that because of which the pot exists. But clay can't turn itself into pot. Clay lacks the power of creation. In the same way, Brahman, if clay is a reality of the pot, Brahman is a reality of the universe. And as clay lacks the ability to turn itself into a pot, Brahman lacks the ability to turn itself into the universe. There must be a creative power, a creative capacity, and that's what we called Maya, correct? So Brahman, when accompanied by this creative power or capacity called Maya, then that's what we refer to then as Ishvara. And we had a long classes and discussions about that pretty recently, so I don't think we need to go. So this is a very technical way of understanding who is Ishvara. Ishvara is Brahman, but not pure Brahman. Ishvara is Brahman accompanied by this creative power called Maya, and therefore Ishvara is empowered by this Maya to be the creator, sustainer, destroyer of the universe. Okay, this end, we just went through a lot of this. Let's come back to this Brahman. This Brahman being the underlying reality because of which the universe exists. So underlying reality, stuff, the true stuff of the universe, the words used in the Taittiriya Upanishad starts with satyam. Satyam means truth or reality, and it refers to Brahman as the stuff because of which the universe exists. But now we've got an interesting problem. The universe in which we live includes lots of stuff which are jada, arguably. Anyway, the universe is both jada and chetana, both insentient and sentient. Now note that the cause has to be capable of creating a particular effect. If this dahi, this yogurt, is the effect, then milk has all the proper requirements. You can't start with clay and get milk. You can't start with milk and get a pot. So the underlying reality has to be suitable for what comes from it. From Brahman comes a universe which is both Jada and Chetana, both insentient and sentient. The word Satyam can certainly accommodate a Jada universe. But the universe is not only Jada, the universe is also Chetana, sentient. How to explain the sentiency? Well, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's another word that's used to define. Notice we're defining Atma as Satchidananda. Now we're defining Brahman as Satyam, that underlying stuff. The next word used is Jnanam. And Jnanam here does not mean knowledge in your conventional way. Knowledge, Jnanam here means consciousness. And because if Brahman were inert without consciousness, how could that inert Brahman be the source of a universe which includes sentiency? So Brahman is the source not only of the stuff of the universe, Brahman is a source of the sentiency of the universe. The word Satyam indicates Brahman as the source of the stuff of the universe. The word Jnanam, which will translate as consciousness, not knowledge. That consciousness is then the source of the sentiency of the universe. And do you see any connection going on here? And we're going to see more of that as we go along. Before we continue, and yes, we're missing one more word. We have to get there. But before we get there, let's understand something about these groups of words. So Atma is Sat Chit Ananda. Here's a question. Atma is you. Are you made of three different things? Do you have some Sat over here, some Chit over here, and some Ananda over there? So they're not three different things, right? They're three words that reveal the nature of who you are. I'm going to share with you something that may sound technical, but ends up being really important. Sat, Chit, and Ananda are not adjectives. And here's why. Adjective, this is orange cloth. Orange is an adjective. Adjectives are variable. I could have orange cloth or blue cloth or white cloth or red cloth. So notice that the adjectives are variable. Cloth, the substantive, is not a variable. Adjectives are that which can vary. You can see orange cloth, red cloth. So which means I can have orange cloth, I can also have cloth which is not orange, right? So if orange is an adjective, so it's possible to have cloth which is not orange. Is it possible to have Atma which is not Sat? Non-existent? Is it possible to have an Atma which is not Chit, not conscious, not sentient? Is it possible to have Atma which is not Ananda, the source of happiness and contentment? So this may sound a little technical. It ends up being really crucial. The words Sat Chit Ananda are not parts of Atma, nor are they adjectives describing Atma. There are three words that reveal the nature of Atma. In Sanskrit, we say they reveal the swarupa, the essence of what Atma is. And these three words are certainly not accidentally chosen. These are the minimum three words. So three fundamental words. Any other words you add on will be adjectives, variable. So you can start adding on words like human, adjective. Male, female, adjectives. Intelligent, adjective. Anything you add on will be an adjective because it can change. What can't change is that Atma is Sat Chit Ananda. So these three words are not adjectives. They reveal the Swarupa, the underlying nature, the essential nature of Atma. And we do exactly the same with Brahman. Brahman is Satyam. That's not an adjective. There's no Brahman which is a Satyam. Brahman is Jnanam. Again, means consciousness here. There's no such thing as an unconscious Brahman. So these are two more words that reveal the essential nature of the Brahman. And there's a third word given in the Taittiriya Upanishad by the Rishi. And the third word is Anantam. So the Vakya that comes, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma Yo Veda Nehitanguhayam Parame Vyoman. And it goes on. So this mantra comes in the Taittiriya Upanishad, in which Brahman is defined with these three different words, Satyam, being referring to Brahman as the stuff of reality, the fabric of existence. That's a nice term. But that fabric of existence can't be inert because existence includes sentient and insentient. So it is a conscious fabric of existence. It is Jnanam and Satyam simultaneously. And it is boundaryless, limitless. Anta means end, ananta, endless. That which doesn't have a boundary, that which doesn't have an end, that which is limitless. So satyam, jnanam, anantam. Anantam, limitless. And look at the connections. So sat, we'll start with chit. It's the simplest one. Chit is you as a your consciousness. Chit refers to your consciousness, your status as a knower, as an observer, as a sentient being. I have to leave out the word being, as sentient. And that sentiency which is chit is the essence of who you are. And in the same way, Brahman, being, if Atma is a truth of who you are, Brahman is a truth of the universe. The universe is also sentient, intelligent, orderly. We've had this discussion before. We don't live in a random universe, particles bouncing around. Remember studying something about Brownian motion? Absolutely random. We don't live in a random universe. We live in a highly intelligent, highly ordered universe. Jnana. So just as consciousness is the essence of you, that consciousness is the essence of Brahman, the reality of the universe, and not only are you conscious, but you exist, and you exist in a very fundamental way, which means you exist in an unchanging way. Sat means existence, but the implication is unchanging existence, unborn existence, uncreated, uncaused, there's our word, uncaused existence. So that's what sat means. That's exactly what satya means. Exactly. So just as sat refers to your uncaused existence, in the same way satyam refers to the uncaused existence of Brahman, the cause of all causes, really speaking, the uncaused cause is Brahman. And that uncaused cause is referred to with the word satyam. And the last connection, we can also see that we have to work on this a little bit more. In what sense do we connect ananda, which is improperly translated as bliss? Why is it an improper translation? Remember, we had this discussion long ago. Bliss is an experience. You are the one having the experience. You are the conscious being aware of the experience of bliss. So if you are aware of the experience of bliss, bliss is known to you. Whatever is known to you is not you. So to Trent, yes, you look up in a dictionary, it says ananda is bliss. Absolutely, that's what dictionaries say. But from a Vedantic standpoint, we have to understand ananda in a more technical sense. You cannot translate it as bliss in an experiential way. So the way we've explained it in this class and the way the Rishis explained it is that source of contentment, peace, joy, love. And the best way to see that is when your mind, the best way to understand ananda is with regard to meditation or deep sleep. And the similarity between meditation and deep sleep is your mind is perfectly quiet. When your mind is perfectly quiet, the only thing left, mind is gone, body is gone, world is gone. What is left? Atma. What kind of Atma? Sat, Chit, Ananda. And how would you describe that condition of deep sleep or perfect meditation? You might use that word Ananda. But you cannot call that an experience. Why? Put it like this is a little tricky, actually. It's easy to say that in deep sleep you experience bliss. And it's true. I know you can't deny it. But a more nuanced interpretation would be in deep sleep, you alone are present as ananda. You are present as sat chit ananda. It's not that you experience bliss. You are bliss. That's where the interpretation goes off. Generally, bliss is something we experience. Ananda is who you are. So in deep sleep or in deep meditation, when your mind is perfectly quiet, what remains is a state of, let's use some different words. What remains is a state of perfection, we could say, a state of completeness, a state of fullness, a state of boundarylessness, a state of limitlessness. In deep sleep or meditation, do you experience any boundaries or limitations? You experience boundarylessness. Not experience. You remain as one who is boundaryless. There is the absence of boundaries or limitations in deep sleep. So in deep sleep or meditation, you alone are present in the absence of any boundaries or limitations. So what remains is boundaryless, what remains is limitless. And that's how we make the connection between ananda and ananta. A condition of limitlessness, which describes your true nature, which is so obvious in deep sleep and in meditation. Now, we're ready to finish this up. These parallels are certainly not accidental. Atma is the truth of you. Brahman is the truth of Ishvara and the truth of the universe. Now the question becomes, that because of which you exist as a conscious being, and that because of which Ishvara exists as a conscious being, do you think they're two different things? Well, the parallels we're starting to see is the most fundamental revelation of the rishis, which says the reality of you and the reality of Ishvara are one and the same, and that is the truth revealed by the Mahavakya, Tat Tvam Asi. These three words, in the briefest way possible, reveal the entire truth taught by the rishis in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta. So what do these words mean? You know the literal meaning, you know, tat means that, tvam means you, asi means you are, so the literal meanings you know. But let's understand it as the rishis used these words. What they meant is this. Tvam, on the surface, tat seems to imply that. Suppose I say that cause of the universe. Which cause of the universe? Well, at one level, Ishvara is the cause of the universe, so suppose we say tat represents Ishvara, and tvam means you, but you, the one sitting in your chair, which we call jiva. And asi, you are, is like an equal sign. Ishvara equals jiva? Does that make, that doesn't make sense. The person sitting in your chair is the creator, sustainer, destroyer of the cosmos? No way. And to make that interpretation is absolutely contrary to what the ancient rishis intended. This is a very complicated three words. There's a whole lot of teaching behind the three words. In fact, there are entire books, texts on the three words. Shankaracharya wrote a text about 60, 70 verses long called Vakya Vritti. Vakya means Mahavakya. Mahavakya means Tattvamasi. So the entire text is all about these three words. You can write a text about just these three words. So there's something a little bit tricky going on here. And here's what's tricky. These words work by implication. Tat, the surface meaning of tat, may refer to Ishvara, but the truth because of which Ishvara exists, the truth of Ishvara, of course, is Brahman. And tvam, at the surface, refers to the person sitting in your chair, but as we've just discussed, the essence of who you are is Satchidananda Atma. So what the Mahavakya reveals is that Satchidananda Atma, the essence of who you are as a conscious being, is identical to Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, the reality because of which everything exists. This is the grand equation, if we can call it that. This is a Mahavakya. By the way, Mahavakyas are many. We often quote four, which are one drawn from each of the four Vedas. But there are many Mahavakyas. The technical definition of Mahavakya is any statement that reveals the identity between the individual and the whole. Any statement that reveals the identity between the individual and Ishvara, or the whole. In fact, there are some people, I don't agree with this, but there are some people who say there's a Mahavakya in the Bible. In the Bible? A Mahavakya? They say yes. At one point, Jesus says, I and the Father are one. Jesus says, I and the Father. Actually, he says, I and the Father are one. It's a stretch to call that a Mahavakya. But I'm just using this as an example of how any statement that reveals the identity, excuse me, any statement that reveals the identity of the individual and the whole, the truth of you and the truth of the cosmos, the truth of you, the individual person, and the truth of Ishvara, the creator, sustainer, destroyer, at the underlying level, they are one and the same. And this is why it's called Advaita Vedanta. This is where the Advaita comes. Otherwise, if you have one Atma plus one Brahman, you don't have Advaita. Or worse, if you count many Atmas. Of course, we can't count many Atmas. We went through that, right? Remember, we had a class in which we said how to distinguish your consciousness from my consciousness. And then we had to admit that there is not a your consciousness and a my consciousness. There's only one consciousness. So there is one consciousness, which means there's one Atma. But if it's one Atma plus one Brahman, we have duality. The Rishi has said, there's not one Atma plus one Brahman. There's Atma which is Brahman. Brahman which is Atma. For all the reasons we just discussed, the definitions of Atma and Brahman lead us to exactly the same place. Which means, and this is the, I can't call it an irony, it's something though, it's very delightful to recognize that when you search within, you start looking inside, and when you look outside, you end up in the same place. Very peculiar. If you go in one direction or if you go in another direction, how can you end up in the same place? Actually, there's a nice metaphor for this in physics. If you're on the equator, if you walk west far enough or you walk east far enough, if you walk due west or due east, you're going to end up in the same place because that planet is one. Wherever there's oneness, you'll find the same truth. Wherever you look. So whether you look within or whether you look outside, you'll find that same one underlying reality, Brahman, which is Atma. But there's a little caveat here. And that is, through the outward turned inquiry. Remember, we started with the table. So through that outward-turned inquiry, there's a tricky question. Did we actually discover Brahman, or did we come to a conclusion that there must be an underlying reality because of which all these names and forms exist? Really speaking, that outward-turned inquiry did not lead us to discover Brahman. We posited there must be some underlying reality. That's not a proof. That's not a discovery. It's a hypothesis. So we said there, we can't find the underlying reality for which this infinite series of names and forms exists, but there must be some underlying reality. That's not a discovery. It's not a proof. How then did we discover Brahman? Not by looking outside. We discovered Brahman, the reality of the universe. Oddly enough, we discovered by looking within. How did that work? Well, by looking within, we discovered that the truth of who we are is Satchidananda. Then we discovered that Satchidananda is Brahman. Meaning, Brahman can only be known as the truth of yourself. Brahman is known only as the truth of yourself, and it turns out that the truth of yourself is the fabric of existence. And that is so non-intuitive, but this is the revelation of the ancient rishis who have given all of these powerful teachings to lead us to this discovery. And the epitome of this discovery, I'll give you one fancy Sanskrit word to wrap this up, and they call it little complicated word, sarvatma bhava. Break it up into two parts. Bhava doesn't mean feeling. Sometimes it can mean feeling. Here it means state, condition, existence. So an existence of sarvatma, the atma of sarva. Sarva, you know, means everything. Sarva atma, the truth of everything. The truth of everything, if we say that would, you know, here we need to know a little bit the use of atma. There's a lot of ways of using atma. We could say atma here means the truth because of which something exists. We could say that the atma of cloth is threads. It's a particular usage of the word atma. The essence of cloth is threads. So we could say that threads are the atma, so to speak, of the cloth. Well, sarvatma, the truth of everything, is atma, which is Brahman. The truth of everything. Everything includes you, me, the universe, and Ishvara. These are the three big realities. You, the individual, the world, and Ishvara. The reality because of which you exist, the reality because of which the world exists, the reality because of which Ishvara exists, that reality is Sarvatma, the Atma of Sarva, of everything. The reality of you, the world, and Ishvara. That reality is Brahman, which is Atma. And it's one and the same. I'll just end with a... we'll end this and have a few more observations, a few more things to share with you. But just to finish this off on a lighter note, this is a little heavy, obviously. What we're talking about is the epitome of Vedantic teachings, the highest realization of the ancient rishis. There's nothing beyond this in Vedanta. Then I hope I haven't told this story before in this class, because I don't like to do that to you. But this story is, this is a true story. So in satsang one day, and this is probably 20, 30 years ago, in Salisbury, Pennsylvania, sitting in satsang with Pujya Swami Dayananda, one of the students asked a question, "Swamiji, I understand that Brahman is the reality of the universe. Brahman is a reality because of which the stars and moon exist. Brahman is a reality because of which the earth and the mountains exist. I understand that Brahman is a reality because of which everything exists. But what about me?" His exact words. "But what about me? Is it possible that Brahman is the underlying reality because of which everything exists with one exception. The person asking this silly question. So anyway, this is just a silly way to illustrate sarvatma bhava, this understanding or condition of being the self of all, is the ultimate goal of these Vedantic teachings. And just to bring it way back to the very beginning, our discussion, especially our discussion today, has been exceedingly philosophical. Absolutely. We've said right at the outset, Vedanta is not philosophy. We said Vedanta is the solution to the problem of suffering. Tell me, if you possess this sarvatma bhava, if you understand this, where is the possibility of suffering? There is only, notice the word only, there is only Sat-Chit-Ananda. There is only Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. To make you suffer, there should be an external agent that can make you suffer. There's nothing outside of you. Everything is within you. Everything is you. There's no agent of suffering. There's no one who suffers. In fact, a brilliant passage in the Mandukya Upanishad, in Gaudapada's commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad, says brilliantly, there's no teacher, there's no student. There's no world, there's no individual. There's no bondage, there's no suffering. Esha paramartata. This is the highest vision. All of these dualities, individual and Ishvara, bondage and moksha, liberation, all of these dualities are imagined and they're the result of ignorance. When these powerful Vedantic teachings destroy all ignorance, all these dualities go away. When all these dualities go away, the duality of teacher and student goes away. The duality of liberation and bondage goes away. All duality goes away. How can there be any suffering with that knowledge, with that vision? So this is just to bring us back to that first point, and that is, even though these teachings are highly philosophical in nature, Vedanta is not philosophy. We distinguish that philosophy is a pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. Vedanta is a solution to the problem of suffering. This knowledge, the knowledge of the ancient rishis, puts an end, an absolute end to suffering. And that's what Vedanta is about. Okay. And another question, a question about, can you recommend some supplemental reading material? And the more general question is, where do we go from here? This is an introduction to Vedanta. There's obviously much more. We hadn't taught an introductory Vedanta class here for about a decade, so I felt really important that we should give such a class. And it opens up a door to a lot of things. On the other hand, we'll talk about the open door, but there's a lot more that you can do on your own to empower yourself further. You know, this is a good start, but there's so much more. In terms of reading, the number of books written on Advaita Vedanta, I don't think you could count them. And there's a lot that's not particularly helpful for various reasons. If you want to read anything, pick a book by Pujya Swami Dayananda. I mean, how could you go wrong with that? In fact, a good place to start is a book called Introduction to Vedanta. Just a small little, maybe 100 some pages. Very nice. And by the way, all of these books are actually edited versions of his public lectures. So he doesn't doesn't write, so there are many books. So you can go to Arshavidya Gurukulam's website or even Amazon.com, and you'll find a bunch of books by Pujya Swami Dayananda, and Introduction to Vedanta is a great place to start. Another great book was that, these are books, by the way, from decades ago. Nice. Another book was Sadhya and Sadhana. There might be the other way around, Sadhana and Sadhya. There are so many books, and most of the books are really small, and so they're easy to read. Some you'll also find, yeah, through Arshavidya Gurukulam, maybe not on Amazon, you'll find then some of his commentaries on various texts, which go into more detail. But you can start, I would say, don't take a commentary on a text as an right now, but rather read the more general books that he has written. That would be a great place to start. Other materials you might find helpful. I've over the last year or two, I took on as a creative project to do a bunch of educational videos. So if you go to our website and look under teachings, you'll find a section on videos, and you'll find a dozen or two educational videos on different aspects of Vedanta. And the reason I'm suggesting that is we all like it's so much easier to watch a video than read a book. Very entertaining, very nice, simple, and also there's something about in a video format, there can be a lot of extra clarity. In this class, we made quite a bit of use of the whiteboard, so you lose that in a book, right? So books generally don't have so much illustration. The advantage of a video, of course, is lots of very clear, powerful illustrations. So I would highly recommend you go to our website and look at those videos. And then when you're ready for something more, two things. One is there's a whole lot of other lectures on our website on various texts. The one text I recommend, the best introduction to the profound teachings of Vedanta is Bhagavad Gita chapter 2. That's it, chapter 2. You don't need to study all 18 chapters, but if you do a thorough study of chapter 2, you'll get the essence of the whole Bhagavad Gita. The chapter 2 actually begins with Arjuna's distress, so it includes that very heavy emotional part, which shows the relevance of Vedanta to solving the problem of suffering. And then it launches into the most profound teachings. It's all there. Chapter 2. You don't have to study all 18. If you want to study all 18, great, go for it. But you don't need to. So a thorough study of chapter 2 would put you in great, great shape. If you want to study further, you can study the entire Gita. There are many other Vedantic texts which I've taught, and all those lectures are available. You can take a text and try it out and see how that works for you. The next, every year in fall, I start a new batch of classes, so including a Vedanta class. So in our Vedanta class, this usually Tuesday evenings is our Vedanta class. This year we're studying the latter part of Chandogya Upanishad, and it's a fairly heavy study. But now that you've gone through this introductory course, you're ready for any of those Vedantic classes. You won't have any problem understanding it. You've got a really good foundation. So next fall, there'll be a new text. I'm not sure exactly what the text will be, but it'll be another. And every fall on Tuesday nights, we'll start a new text. And these are classes that go in considerable depth. And the uniqueness of this class is two things. One is we didn't go into that much depth, so it was introductory in nature. The other unique thing about this particular class is it covered the whole of Vedanta. Most texts don't do that. most texts will take one aspect or another aspect, and that's what you'll see in our Tuesday night classes. So with this broad background, you'll be in great shape. So plan on joining us and for future classes. This will be a good place to wrap up our discussion for tonight. It's been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. And what can be better than going through these wonderful teachings of Advaita Vedanta? And I'm sure that you will take this with you and then continue your process of inquiry. And the further you go, the more rewarding you'll find it becomes. So I wish you well in your ongoing studies. We'll conclude with a prayer. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet. Asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma hamritangamaya. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om tat sat. Very nice. You're welcome. Thank you.